Blog Talk Radio.
Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, with co-host Natan Elaine Kemp. Welcome, Natan.
Great to be back, Bernice.
Oh, great to have you. We want to welcome the callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. If you have logged in as a guest and you wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account or Blog Talk Radio. I will also open the lines in the second half of the show so that you can ask a question or make a comment. Following the show, you can continue this discussion on the Genealogy and History Forum of Afrogenius.com and on my Facebook page, Research at the National Archives and Beyond. Well, I am really happy to have this discussion tonight with all of you. Do your roots need untangling? If so, try stepping out on a limb. Cluster genealogy may hold the clue. Now, our ancestors lived among many. Therefore, we cannot research them as if they lived in isolation. Researching our family history through extended family members, neighbors, and the community may answer questions and provide information about our own ancestors not found elsewhere. Well, my special guest, Dr. Deborah A. Abbott, is an adjunct faculty member at the Institute of Genealogy and Historical Research at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama, and currently serves as the Cleveland District Trustee on the Ohio Genealogical Society Board. She is past president of the African American Genealogical Society, Cleveland, Ohio, and a retired professor of counseling from Community College in Cleveland, and she can pronounce that correctly. She holds both the Bachelor of Science and Master's of Education degrees from Tuskegee University, Alabama, and a PhD degree from Kent State University. So I'd like to give a warm welcome to Dr. Deborah Abbott. Dr. Abbott, welcome to Research at the National Archives and Beyond.
Thank you, Bernice, for inviting me to be a guest on your show. I'm excited about this.
Well, I am excited, too. I mean, just to think about cluster research and to just look at the possibilities is something that's very exciting. But why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you get involved in genealogical research?
Well, I really never paid much attention to family history. And if you had asked me a long time ago, I would have told you all of my family was right here in Ohio with a few people speckled on the East Coast in New Jersey. But one day I received an invitation to a family reunion, and that reunion was in Greensboro, North Carolina. When I opened the envelope, it was from a woman whose name was Debbie, just as mine. And I remembered my grandmother saying that her sister had a granddaughter named Debbie. So the two of them had granddaughters named Debbie. And when I looked at the name of the reunion, it was Lee Lipscomb. And I knew my grandmother's sister was married to a Lee, and I knew my grandmother's mother was a Lipscomb. So I decided to go to the reunion, not knowing not a single person there. And when I got there, they were talking about family members that I had heard only a few little things about, but they knew so much more than I did. And that really made me decide that I needed to know where I came from. So I came back to Cleveland, and I got a plane, and I went to Washington, D.C. to the National Archives so I could look at the census records. And they told me there that I didn't have to come that far, that we had census records here in Ohio, in Cleveland, at the Western Reserve Historical Society. So that really started my interest in family history, and especially when I found my grandmother on the 1900 census as a child.
Wow, and I bet that was exciting to see her name on that 1900 census.
It was exciting. It was... It made me want to do the research because, one, I thought she was from one place, and, of course, in the census record, it has her someplace else. It has her in North Carolina, but it has her in a different township than what I had ever heard. Mm-hmm. And I also saw her name spelled differently. And I have to tell you, my grandmother's name is Marie. That's what I know her by, M-A-R-I-E, Marie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Her sister would come and visit, and she would call her Mary. And we just decided it was because she had a southern accent, and that's how she pronounced Marie.
Mm-hmm.
But in the census records, it was spelled Mary. So
okay.
I thought, well, maybe we have it wrong.
That's
maybe
right.
Maybe that is her name.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's explore this a little bit more because we're talking about cluster genealogy, and of course you said you've got this invitation to a reunion, and you met people who you decided you needed to learn more about. But then again, how do we figure this out? So tell us, how do you define cluster genealogy?
Well, I defined it as trying to research your family through the environment in which they live. I'm always looking at their neighbors, the friends, their extended family, and then I'm always looking at if I can find them. I call them outlaws. Those are the people who used to be married to your family.
Okay.
Those are the outlaws. And if you can find them, especially if you're interviewing, if you can find them, they will tell you everything.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started this process, I'm really a person who operates like a detective. And so the moment I find something that doesn't make sense or it's kind of out of kilter, I stop and try to figure out why. And the first time that I came across this word cluster genealogy was through Emily Crome in Unpuzzling Your Past.
Mm-hmm.
And she explained it very clearly, and I thought, this is what I'm doing already. And now I pay even more attention to it because Elizabeth Shawn Mills has coined what she calls the fan club principle.
Yes.
And so I'm looking at that, making sure that I'm doing what I need to do in terms of researching and solving problems. I'm of the mind that you just cannot leave a census and not know who everybody is in that house. Or looking at your neighbors, and if the neighbors are still around as you move through the census, you need to pay attention to them. So the
mm-hmm.
cluster genealogy is going to be looking at all of the people who are having some kind of interaction with your own family because they may hold the clue that you can't find about your family.
Okay, but you're defining it, you know, trying to research the family through the environment in which they live.
Yes.
But, I mean, what is the purpose, though? I mean, so many people say, oh, I just want to know my single person. That's all I want. I don't want to know about the family. I don't want to know about the friends, just a single purpose. So, I mean, person. So tell us, I mean, there is a purpose to cluster genealogy.
Well, the purpose to me is to break down that brick wall. You have to remember that your families did not, as you mentioned earlier, did not live in a vacuum. they were around all types of people for one reason or another. And so you may never find a death record or a birth record on your family member that you're looking for, but you might find some indication of a birth or death through someone else. Maybe someone kept a Bible, and you find that Bible, and the Bible has the date of your ancestor's birth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not so your ancestor doesn't have that record, but maybe a cousin or an uncle or a grandparent might have the information that you need to verify your own ancestor. So you have to pay attention to the extended family as well as the neighbors and the friends, because we didn't move around by ourselves. We didn't witness our own records. Somebody else did that.
Right.
And so you need all the people around you. And what happens sometimes is that we don't want to spend that amount of time because we think that we're off the beaten path.
Yes.
And
yes.
Sometimes you are, but I always say if you stay on it and just take your time, you'll find out whether or not you're going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Quick.
Well, give us an example of how does cluster genealogy work?
Well, let's see if I can. Let's look at. I'm gonna tell you an example of me researching.
Okay.
Okay. I was researching a family of girls, and girls are usually harder to find because their names change.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't know who they're married to, it's hard to find them. But I was looking for four sisters.
Okay.
I found two of them. I found two sisters who stayed in the area where they were born and married, and I was able to track them. The other two I lost. One sister was married to a man by the name of Leroy Green, and I could tell that through the census. She was married to Leroy Green. They were free African Americans in the state of Kentucky. When I started to look for Leroy Green and his family, I lost them. I lost them in that 1860 census. They did not appear. But the brother-in-law to them was in a court case. And when I researched that court case, got the trial transcription, one of the attorneys asked the question, and this was in 1871. He asked the question, where is Leroy Green? And the answer was, he has removed himself from the state. So that what helped me find Leroy Green was me researching his brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And I found Leroy Green in Yellow Springs, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
with his family. But I wouldn't have done that if I had not been researching the brother-in-law and that court case. That wouldn't have happened. And another example that I can probably give you would be researching and looking for family members. And when you can't find your mother or your grandmother or your great-grandparents, if you don't know who their siblings are, then you may lose them altogether, because even like today, they may become missing. But that doesn't mean that they're deceased. It may
mm-hmm.
mean they've gone to live with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you need to research everybody so you can see if maybe that person has gone on to someone else.
Right. So it definitely is a good strategy to help you break down that brick wall.
Yes. And I always ask the questions when I'm looking at documents or looking for someone. I'm always sitting down and I'm saying, why are they here? Why are they interacting with someone else? You know, if I look at a census and I've got who I think is the family, and then all of a sudden you've got somebody in the family and you don't know who that is, you need to stop and say, why is that person here? What is their relationship to the rest of these people? And it may seem like it's taking you off a beaten path, but you may find that that is a cousin or an uncle or a great uncle, and it may not have a relationship written in the census. The early census don't give us relationships, but sometimes it could be somebody's father, and the census may tell us it's a boarder.
Right.
So you need to look and research that individual to see who they are.
Well, I posted this show on LinkedIn.
Okay.
And the genealogy and historical forum, I mean, the responses were just buzzing all day yesterday and all day today. And I just want to read something to you that Carol Collins wrote.
Okay.
She said, I said earlier that cluster research is about the only way I can solve brick walls, but I didn't elaborate. I should have. I have had two ancestors who were very quiet, no records, vital land, church, or probate. This was the very early 18th century. I finally resorted to searching everyone living around them and anyone who could have possibly or impossibly, it turned out, have a relationship with them. I was told by a descendant of a neighbor that I knew more about his family than he did. But the search was successful. Time-consuming, but enlightening. I have one more to go. Wish me luck.
Well, she has, to me, has just proven that it does take a lot of time. And I had a little bit of that experience last week in Cincinnati. I did a lecture last week, and one of the attendees came up to me and said that she was researching in the same area in Kentucky that I was, and she couldn't find anything. And so I asked her the name of the person that she's looking for, and she gave me the name. And I said, oh, it's more than one person in that county with that name. But she hadn't really looked. She had depended on indexes. And I told her that the person that I was researching had married into the family that she's researching. And so I would agree with Carol that you end up knowing more about other people because you're trying to make that connection to your own.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up knowing more about that community, what happened, the laws, how people moved around, who founded the area, who they brought with them, how the laws would affect your ancestor when they're moving around. You learn so much more about the environment in which your ancestor lived by doing that cluster genealogy.
But then, I mean, let's just talk about this, though, because you're right, you do learn a lot, but how do you build genealogical proof?
Well, I say that you've got to look at all the sources that you have. I usually tell people that they need to pull out all of the records that they've already gathered.
Yes.
And we need to look at those.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to look at not just the names of your ancestor, which is what we tend to do. We
That's
pull
right.
a record, we look at the name of the ancestor, and then we say, we've got it, and
mm-hmm.
we put it away.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to bring it out. You need to bring it out and look at what exactly is on it. You need to see who gave information, especially if you're talking about a death record. You need to see who gave the information. Because on a death record, I always say the bottom part of it is secondary information. We don't know if it's true or not because somebody has given it, and the information that they've given is information that they've been told.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we don't know if it's right or not, so we need to look at that very thoroughly. We need to evaluate who gave the information, and then we probably, if there's a conflict there, then we need to go about trying to resolve that conflict before we go to something else. Can I give you an example?
Of course.
All right, here's an example. I was looking for a man by the name of Lee Vaughn. And from all the things that I had, He should have been born in Greenville County, South Carolina. He should have had a wife named Bell, because Bell showed up in all of the census records as well as the city directory. So he should have had a wife named Bell. He should have been born in Greenville County, South Carolina. And he should have had a father by the name of Doc Vaughn and a mother by the name of Sarah Johnson, if this was indeed my person.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So I pull an obituary first on him. And the obituary tells me, a newspaper obit, tells me that he is from South Carolina, but the city is somewhere on the other side of the state, nowhere near Greenville.
Uh-huh.
It also says that he has, his wife's name is Isabel. That helped me figure out why I couldn't find her, find a death record on her, because I'm looking for Bell. Her name is Isabel.
Okay.
Her name,
mm-hmm.
every document that I had said Bell. And when I tried to find a death record, there was none.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's died under her name, which is Isabel. So that record, that newspaper obit helped me at least find the wife. But it destroyed everything else I had on Levon, because none of it matched.
Okay.
None of it matched. So then I go to a death record. I get the death certificate. And the death certificate says that his father is Levon and his mother is Melinda Foster. That's not what I want.
Okay.
I want Doc Vaughn and Sarah Johnson.
Okay.
The informant is his son, is the deceased's son. So wouldn't you think he should know?
I would think so, yes.
So then what I do is, since I know that the mother is Isabel, I pull the death certificate for Isabel. And on that death certificate, the mother for Isabel is Melinda Foster.
Okay.
Okay? It's Melinda Foster. Now, my analysis of that is that when they completed the death certificate for Levon, they asked him the names of the mother and father, and he gave the name of his grandparents. And that's probably the only grandparents that he knew, was the parents on his mother's side.
Okay.
Okay? Am I making sense?
I'm following. Yes.
Okay. It was the parents on his mother's side that he gave for the parents of his father.
Okay.
When I went after his Social Security application, there was the answer. Because the Social Security number was on the death record. So I sent for the application with that Social Security number. The application came back. The father is Doc Vaughn and the mother is Sarah Johnson.
Okay.
But I just was not going to leave it alone with that obituary, that newspaper obit, which was completely wrong. And the only thing I got out of it actually was the name of his children and where they were from and the name of his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And where he's buried. But everything else about him was not correct. And so, you know, it took a while. It took me having to do some other things to try to correlate that information,
mm-hmm.
and to try to make sure that I had the right person. Because you always can come up with a person with the same name.
That's right.
So I was at least able, I think, to prove that what I was looking at and the person I was looking at, it was the correct person.
Right. Now, so what you're saying, though, you're not only searching relatives.
No, you're not. In that case, I was searching relatives.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not always searching relatives.
Mm-hmm.
You may find that there's people who are doing things for your family that are not relatives of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's what happens a lot of times when you work in slavery. You know, you may be looking for a slaveholder. Sometimes we don't know who it is. Sometimes I've come across one and I wasn't looking for him. He just popped up. And he popped up because this individual's name appeared on almost everything that I pulled for the ancestor I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know who he was, but I thought he's putting up bonds. He's signing off on land deeds. He's a witness. So you need to look to see who he is.
That's right.
So when I found him, and I thought, okay, I'm like any other genealogist. I want this man to die. I want him dead. So that then I can find a will during the slave era.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And then I found out that he was actually the slaveholder to the person I was researching. He was the slaveholder to the wife. And I wasn't looking for that. I was looking for the husband's slaveholder.
Okay.
But because there were so many transactions going on, and this particular name just kept coming up and kept coming up. And then there were other people on there, other witnesses, and I went back to the census and found out they were all neighbors.
Okay.
They were all neighbors. So you're looking at a whole host of people because we just didn't live in isolation.
That's right.
You don't know where the answer is going to be.
That's right. And then tracking those witnesses, you can get so much from tracking the witnesses.
Yes. I was able to find my grandfather's a little bit of, I was trying to recreate his family. And I only knew the names of people, but when I got my grandfather's marriage record, I traced the witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the witnesses, and it's easier, of course, to trace the men. It was two women and a man. And I traced the witness, the male witness, and when I traced that male witness, I found him in the census with my grandfather, where my grandfather was. And he says he's born in South Carolina, same
mm-hmm.
as my grandfather. But they're
mm-hmm.
in North Carolina. That's where they're living. He says he was born in South Carolina. And so I then began to trace that witness. And when I took him back to South Carolina, he is in the same little town where my grandfather is from.
Mm-hmm.
So I still don't know. He's on my to-do list. I still don't know whether or not he is just a good friend of the family or if he is a relative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So once I established that, my thought was maybe my grandfather went to Asheville because Mr. Brooks was there. So I used the city directories and hoped that I would find my grandfather in the house with Mr. Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't there. Who was there? His brother, which was this Levon.
Okay.
He was living in the house with
in
Mr.
the house.
Brooks. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So that told me that they at least know each other.
That's right.
Mr. Brooks is the witness to my grandfather's wedding, and then my grandfather's brother is in the house with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a comment coming. We have several comments in the chat, but one of those comments is from Art Thomas. And he said, seems as if cluster genealogy may reveal family connections that have been lost from previous generations.
He's right. He's absolutely right. Because you may find when you're doing that cluster genealogy, you may find children that you've never heard of, they may exist. Someone may have written about them or recorded them in some manner.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to reconstruct family members. And so you usually get to You get to find members that you didn't know you had. And even in this reconstruction of my grandfather, I have to tell you that I only had names. I had nothing else. I had no age order. I had no family members, no cousins, no anything. And so trying to reconstruct them gave me some idea of children that had been born or died young, or children who had been stillborn. And sometimes we forget to look at stillborn records. There might be a record that shows that a child was born and died immediately.
Right. So, well, there's one other comment coming out, and this is from Angela Walton Raji, and she said, relationships, in-laws, and it explains why sometimes a surname is familiar, but we don't know why. Cluster genealogy can sometimes unravel that mystery.
Yes, and she's right as well, because sometimes we have to look at, and sometimes the names are different too, but we see people that live next door, or we see people with the same name or a different variation of the spelling.
Yes.
And we don't actually think about them being related to your person, especially if you are just focused on your individual person.
Right. Well, we're going to stop with that thought right there, take a quick break, and be back in a minute.
Okay.
At the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, with co-host Natan Elaine Kemp. And you can join me every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where I will have an expert to share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. Remember, all of my guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. Well, you have been listening to Dr. Deborah Abbott discuss cluster genealogy. And I was just looking again at some of the comments that have come out of the Genealogy and Historical Forum on LinkedIn, and Susie Pitenko mentioned that cluster research can be used in almost all forms of research. It is a matter of thinking outside of the box. We are all creatures of habit, and wrote, and need to break out of the mold. So let's just talk more about this. You know, how do you keep track of all of these connections that you were talking about, going to this record and going to that record? Just how are you keeping track of this?
Well, I keep track with a spreadsheet. Elizabeth Shawn Mills keeps track of it with a spiral. And when I first saw that spiral, I thought, I can't do this. So I started using a spreadsheet, but I realized that I'm doing the exact same thing that she has showed you how to do in this spiral. Because what happens is that when you find a document, first of all, you need to make sure that you have cited where you found it and when you found it and what was in it, what you were looking for and what was in it. Because you may have to go back to that same document.
Uh-huh.
And if you start to research in a manner where you don't leave anything until you can resolve it, then you're going to be going back and forth. And your research plan is going to change. because we start out saying, this is what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll find something different, and then you're going to have to revamp your plan. That's exactly what happened when I was trying to make sure I had the right Levon. I wanted Levon because I'm just documenting that that's my grandfather's brother. But the documents didn't match up.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to start over with him, and I had to change my plan and my routine of what I was going to do until I could resolve that issue. But I use a spreadsheet where I put at the top what it is I'm looking for,
mm-hmm.
and I put as much information as I know about that person. And then I make columns, and this may be cumbersome for some, but I make columns that if I'm going through the census, this is what I did in the census, this is who's there, or this is the person that's kind of out of whack there and maybe shouldn't be there, and I need to research them. So mm-hmm. I make columns at the top that tells me what I found, and I even put in there how many times I've looked at that document.
Okay.
Because, go ahead.
There's a question coming out of the chat. Do you have an example of your spreadsheet online?
I don't, but I probably could put one there.
Okay.
Is that what they're asking for?
Yes.
Yes, okay. No, I don't have a spreadsheet online, but I probably can do that.
Okay.
But, you know, I carry that so that I can see what I need to do. If I've got two documents that conflict, I have that there. I say I found a birth record. It doesn't match the death record, or it doesn't match the I have a death record and it doesn't match the obituary.
Mm-hmm.
So that I know that that's what I need to be looking for. And that may mean that the main purpose, which was to reconstruct my grandfather's family, has to wait for a minute until I can resolve the conflict. But Elizabeth Shone Mills has that spiral. She uses a spiral. And she uses it because you're going to keep going back. And the purpose of it is to be able to correlate that information that you find and prove what it is that you're looking for.
That's right. Now, we do have a question, and you're live, area code 619. You have a question or a comment?
Hi, this is Susie Pentico.
Oh,
hi,
hello,
Susie.
I just wanted to say I have given two presentations in the last 6 weeks regarding using your research log.
Okay.
And that is what she's talking about. You log where you found it, when you
yes.
found it. You log if you found good information or bad.
That's
if
correct.
If you found good information, you know that you want to go back there if you're going to look for more information. You want to log when. You want to log where. Your speaker is very heads up, but the research log is what really does the situation.
And I also look at bad information, too. I go back to it because it's bad when I first start, but it might be the right information.
Yes, because as you said, if you do it through the brother-in-law, the cousin, the nephew,
yes.
whatever you want to find, it's just very vital. The only thing I do with my research logs is I do it by surname.
Okay.
I don't do it by a group. If I'm doing the Hoffmans, it's a Hoffmanser log. If I'm doing it by the Jones, it's a Jones log. So that if I'm dealing with a deed and I've read it, and I got some information, but there's something's not right. I want to know where I got it. I want to know where I'm going back to get it so I can reconfirm what it does or doesn't do.
Okay.
The other thing is when you're dealing with wills, probates, guardianships, land records, you have to go back to the old method of when you were in high school and they took a sentence and you had to diagram it.
I do that all the time.
You take
I
it
do.
And, yes, and if you separate it, you get the names, you get the what and where for each person mentioned in that, you don't miss the data. Because I had a Civil War records. I'll bet I read them 20 times. I was so excited with all what was in them. I ended up doing a talk for the society, and I pulled it out, and I was looking at it, and I said, how did I miss that? And it's because we're creatures of habit.
And you
that's
have to,
right.
you
and
have
it's
to
so
dissect
easy for that
it.
To happen. Right.
Yes. You have to
yep.
dissect what you get. Every time you get something new, you need to take the time to dissect that information and to take it apart.
Right.
And we don't do that.
Separate piece of paper, and you put it in
mm-hmm.
your folder, and
mm-hmm.
you keep it. Because, as I said, if all of a sudden your Jones is married to a Townsend, then you see where the link is. And sometimes you're looking at the census and there's a bunch of Townsends, but there's no Joneses. But you want to keep track of where they
sure,
are and who they
sure.
are, because it's going to send her a
right.
later link.
That's right. Well, thank you very much, Susie,
yep.
for
mm-hmm.
calling in.
Thank you.
Take okay. care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Now, there's a question coming out of the chat, and the question is, does Dr. Abbott have a standard checklist that she uses to make sure that she has covered her bases?
I don't know if I want to call it a standard checklist. I'm using what I call the basic genealogy methods.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we normally start out doing interviewing and oral history. And when we get that oral history, we should not take it as the gospel. We should be going about trying to prove the information that's there, because you could get different information from different people
right.
for the same subject.
Mm-hmm.
But if I get a will, then I do, as is her name Susie, as she has said, I take it apart. This is who the witnesses are. I try to see where they are. Here are the people who are in the will, and this is what they're getting. And if there's something in there about land, then I'm going to try to pull deeds. I'm going to make that checklist based on whatever document I'm looking at.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably the easiest way to say it. I don't have a standard checklist per se, but every document that I'm looking at, I'm trying to make sure that I cover those bases to make sure that what I have is going to be accurate.
Now, I'd just like to just throw it open to anyone who would like to call in and make a comment or ask a question. The number is 646-200-0491, and press 1 to speak to the host. So what we're doing is we're piecing together information. So how do you actually, I mean, you talked about the spreadsheet, but let's say we're looking at clusters and there's collateral evidence. I mean, there's
yes.
stuff out there. How are we pulling all of this together?
Well, I pull it together by looking at who I have. And when you say that we have the collateral line, which is our family line, and then we have the cluster. That's our neighbors and friends and all of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really trying to make sure I'm reading social histories.
Mm-hmm.
We have to understand the environment where our families are living.
Mm-hmm.
We have to understand the laws that affect them, especially if we're looking at slave ancestry. We've got to understand the laws. We've got to understand the environment where they are. And we've got to understand what's going on around them. And a lot of times what I'm doing is writing little snippets of what it is. I need to make sure that if I'm looking in 1850, then I know what that law is in 1850. I know what's going on in that community in 1850. So
mm-hmm.
it may mean that you're having to stop doing genealogy and read some history books.
Yes.
You
yeah.
may need to read the history as I did before, and I'll just say I read the history of Kentucky, and I did that just by doing the census records, and I found all of these black people who were free. All the way back to 1840, free
mm-hmm.
in Kentucky. My brain as a detective says, why?
Mm-hmm.
Why are they free?
Mm-hmm.
The only way I'll know that is by reading the history of Kentucky and slavery, learning about the history of blacks in Kentucky, learning about the history of the county and the township where those people live. What's going on that would allow that to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, then you are able to see what kind of records at least should have been created to help you track your individuals. Where we're looking at their immediate line or their neighbors and friends.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are two questions coming out, both from Angela Walton Raji. One is, what is a good method of zoning in on those social histories? Because many beginning researchers don't know that they exist or where to find them. And then following up with that question, do you have any method of finding the published journals?
Well, some of the published, well, let me go back and do the books. One of the easiest ways, to find the histories or the social histories, and especially if you don't live in that area, is by using your local library and using the database of WorldCat. And when you use WorldCat, if you put in the search engine box, if you put in something like Cuyahoga County, Ohio history, books that relate to that will appear. The good thing about WorldCat is it'll tell you which library closest to you may have that book.
Mm-hmm.
If the libraries are too far away, then use your local library to bring those books to you.
Mm-hmm.
And the library can do the interlibrary loan. The other way of getting those history books is sometimes to use Google Books, because those books sometimes are digitized,
mm-hmm.
or to use Family History, FamilySearch.org,
mm-hmm.
and looking for the histories of the areas where you're looking for. Or if you want slavery in a state, slavery in Ohio, you put that in, and anything that's relevant to that will appear. And so those are easier. The journals, a lot of the journals you can find at Allen County Public Library if you're looking for journals, or at a college or university library and JSTOR, you might be able to find some of those.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so your libraries become important. University libraries become important, and the public library where your ancestor lives becomes very important,
mm-hmm.
because you may find information in the archives there, in the manuscript collections. You won't find books in the manuscript collections, but you can find information on what's going on with your ancestors so that you can get a feel of that social history.
Right, and we also have another recommendation that you should also start with your local historical society.
Yes, yes, with the genealogical societies.
That's right.
In those areas. So your historical societies, your gen societies, and also make sure that you use those libraries, the public
right.
libraries and private libraries.
And, Nathan, you've also had an experience recently.
Yes, people may overlook this fact, but the tourist information office in a particular county
yes.
Could be very helpful. I stopped by one in Caroline County, Virginia. I was looking for a historic map of Caroline County and found one. And it turns out the tourist information officer is also a genealogist. So I was able to ask her some questions, and she was very helpful.
That helps. And also, when you are looking, I'm always looking for the land ownership maps as well.
Yes.
And you can find those sometimes in your courthouses or with the Department of Transportation. Now, sometimes I wonder why it's there, but I've found some there before. But to use the local resources is something that, and sometimes you can call them on the phone. If you know exactly what you're looking for, you may be able to get it if you just call them on the phone. But I had a friend who was looking for a house where her ancestors had been slaves, and the house had been moved. And just as the caller just mentioned, the Department of Transportation was able to tell her how and where they moved that house.
Well, Dr. Abbott, we have a a question, a recommendation coming out of the chat, and
okay.
we would like you to explain your methodology for researching Jason Hicks from Slavery to Freedom in Ohio.
Jason Hicks, I didn't know anything about Jason Hicks. Let me just start with that. I was researching a family from Troy, Ohio, which is Miami County. And as I researched back, of course, using the census, I come across Jason Hicks. And Jason Hicks is in Ohio in 1840. He's in the census in 1840. In 1850, I can see that he has children, and he has 9 of them, 6 born in Virginia and 3 born in Ohio. So I at least know from that oldest child that he has been in Ohio at least since 1837. But again, I needed to understand what's going on in Ohio that all of these people, because I looked at the census, and there's a lot of people in the census from Virginia, African Americans, why are they there? And so as I researched Ohio and its laws in regards to African Americans, I find that as soon as we became a state in 1803, that those, in 1804, we created what they call black codes. And usually you find black codes in the southern states.
Uh-huh.
But Ohio had black codes in 1803, and those laws were generated to help monitor the movement of African Americans in the state of Ohio. And so one of the things, when a African American came into the state, they had to prove that they were not runaways. And so in order to do that, they had to go to the courthouse, and they had to file their papers that showed that they were actually free. They had to pay 12.5 cents in 1803. In 1807, we changed the law, and the people had to pay $500 and find 2 people to vouch for them. And so I went to find the register in Ohio for free blacks coming into the state. Jason Hicks was in Logan County. I found the register. The register should have been in the courthouse. It was not. The copy of it was with the Historical Society, and the original was at Wright State University. So even though those records should have been in the courthouse, they were not.
Mm-hmm.
They were with the university. The original is with the university. But when I got the register with Jason Hicks's name on it, it told me exactly where he came from. It gave me a description of him. And it told me when he came to Ohio, which was 1835. He was from Southampton, Virginia. I was able to compare the Southampton, Virginia free registers with that register in Ohio, and saw that these people moved from Southampton, I'm going to say in communities. There were all kinds of families that came at the same time. And I could tell by the register, by the date that they filed for their freedom with the state of Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I researched, then I find that they intermarry, because they know one another. They came there together.
That's right. Yeah.
So they marry each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then I find that I can find records of the Hickses in the records of the Byrds.
And that's because they're intermarrying.
They're intermarrying, and they're community.
Mm-hmm.
They are community. They're
mm-hmm.
neighbors. They're community people. So the whole community moved to Logan County.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell that by comparing those 2 registers, those lists.
That's right. And I mean, as Art is saying right now, cluster research again.
Yep. Yes.
Cluster research. Well, now, have you encountered any surprises with your own research?
Well, let's see. Yes, I have. And it's with, again, with my grandfather's family. And you have to know that I lived with my grandfather all my life. Nobody ever came to visit. Nobody ever sent a letter, nor did he visit or send any letters. And I heard from my grandmother that he had a nephew that went to prison for life at the age of 18. And I was able to find that nephew. And so if he's in prison for life, you would think that I should be able to find a death record, but I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I found that he had gotten a pardon. So he had got out of jail, and I still couldn't find him. And then I thought, again, that maybe he wouldn't stay in South Carolina. I don't think I would have. So I searched for him across the country, and I find him in Ohio, and I find him in Columbus. And that was a surprise because that meant that my grandfather had family members in Ohio, in Columbus, which is only 2.5 hours away from us.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't know it.
Oh.
But when I used the city directories to try to determine when he came, I found all of his siblings. They also had come. And I was able to determine who came first, who came next, until all of them were in Ohio from South Carolina. That was a big surprise.
I bet you that was a big surprise.
And I thought my grandfather never knew it.
Oh, which is unfortunate. Which is so unfortunate.
Yes, he never knew it. So he had nieces and nephews right here in Ohio that he didn't know anything about.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another comment coming out of the chat, and it's interesting because it's referencing those who are have tested the DNA.
Oh, my goodness.
And
okay.
Okay, so this comment, this is Shannon. Hi, Shannon. 23andMe users, know those clusters of matches all sharing the same DNA segment, collaborating with them using the methods here can demolish brick walls.
Well, I'm in agreement. I am just now starting to look at DNA. So I'm not a DNA expert, and I'm not able to really talk about that, but I know that once when you find your family members and it happens that the DNA can match you up with a cousin, which is not a direct line,
mm-hmm.
can match you up with aunts and uncles. But I can't talk about DNA.
Certainly. But we have many, many people who have matches.
Oh, I know that.
And they're trying,
I know that.
They're trying to make sense out of all of these matches. And so if there's a methodology that perhaps they want to consider, cluster genealogy, a cluster research certainly may help them.
Help them do that.
Help
yes.
them do what they need to do.
Yes.
So do you have any parting advice for designing your cluster research plan of action?
Well, the one thing that I always say is that you've got to be patient. We tend to, as one of the callers say, we are a creature of habit. And so we don't pay attention to the records that we have. And we need to make sure that we go back and look at what we already have.
Mm-hmm.
And determine what we need to do, because you may already have in your record keeping a conflict inside of those records. But you need to look at what you have, determine where you need to go and what you're looking for. If you need to find an ancestor, a female ancestor, and you're having a hard time with the maiden names, just remember that you've got to search them through the men. They don't exist except for in the men prior to the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So I say just Just be patient, try to be organized, and there's going to be times, and you have to recognize it, when you've got to put that genealogy down and you've got to start reading so that you understand where you need to go and what you need to look for and what exists.
Okay. Nathan, any questions, any comments?
In terms of comments, I would say turn over every stone, just as an example. On Monday, I was at the Louisa Circuit Court, and my mom and I were trying to figure out exactly where some land was located that our ancestors owned, and we pulled out the plat record, and I saw land that my second great grandfather owned, because it's still in his name, a third great grandmother owned, but then I recognized another name, and it was the wife of my second great grandfather.
See there?
And
yes.
In the courthouse, they have a book from the tax office saying who is presently paying taxes on that land.
Yes.
And so I looked up that name, saw the name in Washington, D.C., called the person. He's the grandson of my second great grandfather's brother.
See? Yes.
And that's why I need to know as many names as possible. And I never knew about this until I looked at the plat record and learned she actually had purchased the land the year before she got married.
Okay. And also on those plat records, the neighbors could be related. When you look at those land maps, you could have a brother-in-law or a married sister, you know, owning the land that's connected. So you have to pay attention to that as well. Who lives around them? And a lot of times we don't do that.
That's right. We don't even look two doors down.
No, we don't. We don't.
We
look
don't.
Too...
You have people in the same household with different names, and people just say, "Oh well, they're not related."
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason those people are in that household.
Yeah, well, we don't always pay attention to that, and since you know the census is probably the earliest thing that we do. We need to make sure that we don't leave those households until we can identify every single person in that house, and then to look around and see if there's someone there with the same last name, to look to see where people are born, because we don't pay attention to that, because that could indicate a migration.
Uh-huh.
If they're coming from the exact same place. So, and then don't forget that our ancestors also participated in social organizations, in churches. So if you can find some of those church records, if you can find indication that they may have been part of a church, then you need to see if you can find the church records. And they're not always easy to find, but you may be able to find them either in the church themselves or in the archives or the historical societies. And to see who's there, who's paying taxes, paying tithes, and just see if they match the other people that you've come across, the witnesses in your deeds, the witnesses in the marriages, to see if any of those people are among the people among your ancestors, and participating with them and interacting with them.
That's right. That's right. Well, I hope everyone has really understood what cluster research can do for you. And I'd just like to just talk to you about what's coming up. Well, next week I'm going to have Dr. Carla Peterson. She is the author of Black Gotham, A Family History of African Americans in 19th Century New York City. And so that show is next week at 9 o'clock. Also, I tried something out on Sunday, and it was a live reenactment called Stories from Sandy Spring. Now, this story involved two brave women and one child, and they escaped the bonds of slavery by going through the Underground Railroad. So if you have not listened to the show, please check it out. It's Stories from Sandy Spring. And then I have a final announcement for those of you in the Washington, D.C. area. The African American Interest Group of the Washington, D.C. Family History Center and the Augs Prince George's County Chapter is sponsoring a special program in celebration of Black History Month on Saturday, February the 16th, at 10 o'clock at the Washington Temple Visitor Center, and that's located on Stony Brook Drive in Kensington, Maryland. You will have an opportunity to see the African American Interest Group of Washington, D.C.'s lovely heritage quilt, and this is a quilt that the group has put together, and they will share with you the life and events which inspired that quilt. Also, they will feature another speaker, Sharon Tyndale, and she will discuss quilt blocks in African-American life. And then we will have two classes, one, the African-American Inventive Brilliance with Patricia Sloby, and Beginning African-American Genealogical Research with Carolyn Rose. So I hope that you all, if those who are in the Washington, D.C. area, will visit. So I'd like to just say to everyone, good night. Thank you so much, Dr. Abbott. Thank you, Natan, for co-hosting tonight. And remember, your ancestors left footprints all over the place.
Yes, they
so
did.
You're not just looking at that one person, people. Look at the neighbors. Look at the friends. Look at the acquaintances. Also, I mean, remember, you should follow all of the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives, and beyond. So let's keep this conversation going, everyone, on Facebook, LinkedIn, Afrogenius, research at the National Archives and Beyond Facebook page. Let's just keep talking about this. And remember to listen to the African Roots podcast with Angela Walton Raji on Friday morning and Nurturing Our Roots with Antoinette Correll on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. So thank you so much for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, with co-host Natan Elaine Kemp. Thank you so much. And remember, all of my shows are available as a podcast immediately after the broadcast. So good night, and I look forward to you joining me next Thursday. Good night, Natan. Good night, Dr. Abbott.
Good night.
Good night.
Okay. Good night.